Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartok, your host of Film Wax Radio. You're listening to episode number 408. Thanks to everybody who came out to my event this past Monday. We did a screening of this HBO documentary called Very Semi-Serious. It was also a reboot of my screening series, Docularius, which is when I screen funny documentaries. So we screened this movie again, Very Semi-Serious, which is about the New Yorker cartoon department and the man who, until recently, was the editor of that department, Bob Mankoff, just about the culture there at the New Yorker cartoon department and also Bob's life and the lives of a handful of, or some cherry-picked cartoon contributors, three of whom, by the way, we had at the screening on Monday, as well as Bob Mankoff himself. Now, Bob has moved on to Esquire, where he is now the humor and cartoon editor. But he came out, and he was great, and so were my three other cartoon panelists, who are Emily Flake, Mort Gerberg, and Liana Fink. If you haven't seen the film, and if you have access to HBO, or HBO Go, or HBO Now, whatever it is, go check it out. It's a great film. Anyway, we did have, the screening was at DCTV, which is a documentary media production facility and resource center that is in Chinatown, just a couple of blocks south of Canal Street, and in a converted firehouse. I've had a long-term relationship with the people there, and it's a joy. So we did the screening. We had a really, really lovely turnout. You know, all my panelists came out, and it was just one of these things where everything, you know, all the planets aligned, and we had a great time. So thanks to everybody who came out. And you can subscribe to the Film Wax Radio newsletter, by the way. If you go to filmwaxradio.com, there is a place to plop in your email address and get on the new. I don't send out many newsletters. I mean to. I intend to, but I just don't have the wherewithal, and I don't do it. I'll try to get to the point where I'm maybe doing one a month at least, maybe two occasionally, but one a month, telling you what's going on. I did send out a couple about the event on Monday night of Docularius. So there's that. This episode, I've been meaning to get filmmaker Amir Bar-Lev on this show for years. That's no joke. He's made a number of great documentaries, and he has a great track record. And if you haven't seen his films, I'm happy and excited to bring to your attention which ones they are. I'm going to just mention sort of his projects, not the works for hire that he's done. He broke into the scene in about 10 years ago with a documentary called My Kid Could Paint That, which really got a lot of attention because there was a questioning of the veracity. I mean, you know, you couldn't be sure exactly what was going on here. Essentially, it was about this young girl named Maria Olmsted, who decided at 4 years old to be a painter. And then it was, she made all these incredible paintings, and, you know, they were put in a gallery, she was given a show, and then it was questioned, did she really paint these paintings, or was she coached? So if you haven't ever seen My Kid Could Paint That, go rent the movie. It is entertaining and fascinating. That was in 2007. I think he followed that up with The Tillman Story, which is also a terrific film about a professional football player turned Marine, I believe. And he was killed, Pat Tillman. And basically the military decided to take this story. He was killed by friendly fire, I should add. And of course the military had to try to spin the story, and it became very controversial. And Amir follows this story and uncovers, basically shines sunlight on it, you know. And he went from that film to Happy Valley a couple years ago. This film you've got to see as well. This one is about the whole story that follows the sex abuse crimes by Jerry Sandusky and the subsequent cover-ups by the leadership at Penn State, and about the college football culture and the impact of what was going on there with the people in that culture. It's a really an amazing documentary. So do go check it out. Amir's latest documentary is called Long Strange Trip. And I'm just going to say it's executive produced by Martin Scorsese. It is 4 hours in length, but don't let that put you off, even if you're not a Grateful Dead fan. You don't have to be a deadhead to love this film. It's beautiful. It sounds incredible. And we're going to talk to Amir about this film. Now, I wasn't able to work so fast because I talked to Amir yesterday, which was Wednesday. Tonight, Thursday night, as I record this, there was a whole bunch of one-off screenings at theaters around the country of this film, which, you know, enjoys 7.1 surround sound. So it's really a great oral experience, you know. And then it is, as of today, Friday, the 26th of May, it is in theaters theatrically in at least a small number of select cities. And on June 2nd, Long Strange Trip will be available on Amazon Video Prime. But if you have an opportunity, if you're a fan of the music, and if you live anywhere near one of the theaters where it's playing, I wholeheartedly recommend you go see it, because it's going to look and sound spectacular. And I'm not going to bore you with too many details. We're going to go into that conversation in just a minute. But first, let me go to this little commercial here with this wonderful product called Magic Drop. Hey everybody, new sponsor for the show, Magic Drop. Magic Drop is a music licensing business based in Brooklyn, New York, which represents an eclectic roster of bands and composers licensing their music for use in films, TV, and beyond. Magic Drop works directly with clients to find songs or instrumentals from a catalog of 1,000-plus tracks by artists with distinctive developed voices. Magic Drop offers competitive rates and festival licenses for independent filmmakers. Visit MagicDropMusic.com or email contact@MagicDropMusic.com for more information. Again, that's Magic Drop. I welcome them to the podcast. Now, the other segment I'm going to introduce in just a little bit after my conversation with Amir is a conversation I had with this young man named Lorenzo Fiuzzi, who, along with a few of his colleagues, has a SVOD, streaming video on demand platform that he has created called Filmatique. And you can go to filmatique.com and get a trial period of, you know, for free. And then it's, I think, about $5 a month you get to get. And you can watch all these great international art films that only people like me who go to film festivals around the world get to see. And now you can see them right in the comfort of your own home. So we're going to talk to Lorenzo about that in just a little bit. But first, let's go right now into my conversation with this exceptional documentary filmmaker, Amir Bar-Lev, regarding his new documentary, Long Strange Trip.
What is it about the Grateful Dead?
Grateful Dead. The narrative of the Grateful Dead was that we're the same as you. You're the same as us. There is no real distinction.
The camaraderie and the fellowship in that is so powerful.
Yeah, let's have some fun.
We were experimenting with psychedelics as much as we were playing music.
It's a philosophy of leaving yourself open to possibility and leaving yourself open to magic.
The acid test experience really formed the band as a group mind.
Within 30 minutes, I could find any drug that I want.
Uh-oh.
At 4 hours, this is a... I might add, the quickest 4 hours one can spend watching a movie. It's like it gets that kind of... I know Martin Scorsese is the executive producer, but it kind of gets that same real nuanced, indulgent feeling that, in the positive way, that like the George Harrison documentary and the Bob Dylan got and this. So it's really, it's refreshing. There's also a great one, Tom Petty, did you see that one?
I didn't ever see that, but that's long, right? That's about 8 hours or something.
No, I think it's four, but I could be wrong.
Okay, no. It's,
I could be wrong.
No, you're probably right.
And what's his name? Peter Bogdanovich.
Yes,
exactly. I think he. Yeah,
right.
Right. See, there's editing.
Yeah, Cicillo did the.
He did the Doors. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
But was that a doc? Yeah, it was a documentary, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was brief. The extended version. But so why did you do? I was speaking with Amir Bar-Lev, by the way, director of, well, among other films, My Kid Could Paint That. My Child Could Paint That.
No, My Kid.
My Kid.
My Kid.
My Kid Could Paint That. Tillerman.
Tillman.
Yeah. Tillman.
Yeah.
I'm going to fuck up everyone on the stupid. Right, yeah.
Just I won't put you on
terrible
the spot.
Host.
Yeah, yeah. I've Happy Valley. And,
can I, and Happy Valley. Sure. And I can I tell you, I've seen all of those films as they've come out.
Oh, great.
Several in theaters probably, like at, or press screenings, because I'm a fan of your films. And
well, I appreciate you saying that.
Even though my memory isn't serving
it doesn't matter,
me all that
my
well.
My memory is...
But Strange Long Trip, however.
Somebody said that the other day, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's such a familiar title when associated with Grateful Dead. But why, to get back to my question, which I was trying to ask, is why such a robust length and approach to telling the Grateful Dead story?
The reason we made it as long as it is because we felt that most music documentaries fall short because the medium doesn't match the message in a way. And, you know, I said, well, look, if we were making a film about a comedian, it should be funny. And if we're making a film about sex, it should be sexy. And these are experiential things. Music is like food or sex or humor. It's not a thing that's easy to talk about.
Or food.
Yeah. 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 But people can talk about it, but you know, you also want to enact it or evoke it at the same time as you're talking about it. And so we, you know, the Grateful Dead, had a 40-year journey. They did long shows for a reason, but also they had everybody would solo at the same time. You know, they didn't take turns soloing. They created a kind of a wall of, you know, a dense wall of sound. So we wanted to make a film that had a, this will sound highfalutin, but a kind of a holographic quality to it, where there's a kind of a churn of images, motifs, and over time, that symbolic universe shifts and kind of expands. But by the end, you can use things for a tiny amount of time, but the audience will have a shared set of meaning with you. Mm-hmm. So it felt like we kind of wanted to make the film musical and have a dream logic. And this is a long answer to your question, but that's why it's 4 hours. And I like to think it's not only long, but deep, you know, it's dense.
Right.
One of our editors,
describe it.
We have two lead editors. One of them was, his name is John Walter. He's a director of fine films of his own, in his own right. But he's of late gotten excited by, the radio documentaries of Glenn Gould, the pianist. And Glenn Gould was hired by the CBC, I think, to go up into the Arctic in the
Canadian
late 60s.
Canadian Broadcasting Company for those.
That... Yeah. And he did something akin to what we did, where he let people talk over one another.
He used to moan above his piano playing, didn't he? Was that, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Was known for kind
yes.
of making
uh-huh. yeah, that's right.
one
yeah.
of the things he was known for.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you may not know that he also was a radio, radio documentarian. Yeah,
I did not. I don't remember that. I remember that documentary, the 30 something.
Yeah, no, that was. I think that was a narrative.
Scene.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it was a. Maybe it was a hybrid of sorts, but anyway.
Anyway, so that was one. That was one of our points of influence, and then the other, just briefly, is Keith Fraze, my second editor, comes from Terrence Malick's stable. He cut the last few Terrence Malick films, and so he and you know Terry also has that sense of a kind of a fugue, a dreamlike fugue
for sure.
And so we tried to bring both of those, you know, we borrowed or stole from both of those camps, and then you know brought obviously some different stuff to bear. But those were some of our reasons for cutting it the way we did.
Also among your with Alex Milliard.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He's in your club too, right? Because I know Alex.
Yeah, talented filmmaker, and we cut for a long time, so we ended up having a lot of great editors. Michael Levine is another one who worked with me on My Kid Can Paint That. Cut Restrepo, and then Amy Foote, who cut many things, but among them the new Mavis film.
So, oh, right.
Yeah. That was and then there's one other guy named Brian Funk, which is amazing how many editors we had on this. And he cut Happy Valley some other things, too. Yeah.
So do you feel as an experience is the maybe the first, I don't know, because I know you also made a couple of other projects or been involved with a couple of other projects around the music industry, correct? Or
Yeah.
But I don't know if the length, the running time on those, but I didn't know if this was satisfying then, because it's like, as you can tell, not only do you get that length and depth, as you put it, I mean, you do get the ability to take your time to tell a nuanced story. So by the end of it, you really do have such a greater, deeper sense of who not only Garcia is, but who this band as an entity is.
Yeah.
And the time and the context, you know, you really get so much more out of a project that's this long, you know.
The other two films that I've done in the music world, I'm proud of, but they had a lot of creative cooks in the kitchen.
They were for hire?
Yeah, they were there for hire. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's great work. I actually intend to seek it out even more. But but that said, this one, we were really lucky to have a band that allowed us to, you know, have creative control. And that's not a small thing when you're dealing with rock stars who are used to, their image is they're used to having their image handled. But these guys, to their great credit, don't care too much about their image and trust people around them to do their own art and work in their own medium and they kind of stick to theirs. And so that's one substantive difference between those other two films and this.
For those who, you know, are interested in seeing it and considering it, which it will be on, play
when are people going to be hearing this?
Well, for sure. I was trying to time this before the, because there are some theatrical.
Yeah, on Thursday, the 25th, which is 2 days from the moment we were recording this, there'll be a.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. It's possible.
Yeah, it'll be in 50 different cities and.
In the states and Canada or
not in Canada?
Just in the states. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then after
not San Francisco, of course.
I got you. No, it's three different cinemas in my hometown, the Bay Area.
Oh, very good.
And then on the day after
the
Castro? On the 26th. No, it showed at the Castro though. That was
it did?
Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure. I only hear that. People always say whenever describing a screening
a
at the Castro, the word "unbelievable" is always in the same sentence.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
true. So.
Yeah.
Okay,
and it'll be in
and then
in
it's
going to
be
for
on
a week in LA and New York.
Yeah, well, this
26.
Is definitely, even though I mean, again, you're going to go. And, I mean, I've sat through much longer films, but it's going to be worth it because it's going to just be gorgeous. It's going to look gorgeous,
gorgeous,
and the music,
and
it's
going to
sound. The sound is going to be gorgeous.
I can tell you one thing. I mean, we mixed this film for about 6 months. I've never had the luxury of working like that, but we had Scorsese's team. They've done a bunch of other stuff, but that's how they came to us via the EP Marty, and they were given amazing tools. Not to geek out too much, but basically we got the stems, the individual instruments from the Grateful Dead's music vault. So if you take a song, you know, off a studio album like Truckin' or whatever, we got the 16 tracks, so you could pan the sound out to the theater. This is all by way of saying I encourage people to see this in the theater, because
I may have to go.
It's like seeing it. It's really like seeing it. Uh-huh. It's like being immersed in the music.
Yeah.
And we did this incredible 7.1 surround 7. Sound 1, mix.
Now.
Yeah, not 5, yeah. 7. And it's amazing. I mean, it's like, the scene when, and, you know, we had a lot of fun with that too. So, like, you know, it shifts, it pans and shifts, and, you know, and it's thematically driven. So, you know, when there's
a little trippy.
Like, yeah, it's trippy.
Experience.
Yeah.
It's going to be a trippy
yeah.
experience.
Yes.
So, we're not encouraging people, because, you know, we're responsible. We're not going to encourage people to take mass transit in any kind of altered
right.
frame
yes.
of mind.
No.
But if you do, I think, you know, there might be benefits here.
There will be other people
yeah.
who, it'll be fun to be with other people at
but
these screenings.
But don't drive yeah. and do that.
Yes.
But do, if you decide to yeah. do that, go see this movie because I think it'll be a great experience.
It'll be
you.
The funnest thing to do on Thursday night.
yeah.
yeah.
So we should also talk about the fact that we'll get maybe back to Marty in a bit, this documentary, and I was already asked by somebody at my job the other day who I said, you know, I'm watching this new documentary by Amir Barlev, and you know, it's on, and he goes, oh yeah, I heard about it, and he goes, what's the way in? And I'm like, well, this is not, it's told by the dead. And like the inner circle, this is like kind of all the people that were in the real inner circle and who really knew the dead or were the dead, and with a few missing people potentially. But, and this is getting to my question in a most roundabout way, but of course, Jerry Garcia couldn't participate in the documentary, yeah. although yeah. he is interviewed throughout. It's sort of a through line.
Yeah.
Is this interview that you have. And his presence is felt in this documentary.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if he felt that connection after the end of the...
Like I hope so, yeah. I mean, I did, and I hope the audience gets that too. I mean, it can't be understated how eloquent Jerry Garcia was. He's an incredibly, you know, one of our characters is his publicist, and he said, you know, I would often get frustrated because this is not in the film, but you know, Jerry was such a conversationalist mm-hmm. that oftentimes pieces would come out that this publicist had arranged, and they wouldn't have the kind of the information that the publicist had been interested in getting out there, the new album dropped or whatever, because Jerry had asked, you know, for 3 hours they sat together and Jerry ended up on some tangent asking the guy about his kids or whatever, the reporter. So Jerry's great in an interview setting. We actually, you're right, there to the audience, it'll look as though there's one interview with Jerry. In actuality, we transcribed every interview that he ever did that we could find over years' time.
Considering how long his career was, and it's not as long as it could have been, he could still be around playing, but was there more than like, I mean,
oh, there's
some people that have been around, like Jagger
has been
around for,
he liked doing interviews.
He did do it because it doesn't, there's yeah. a bit of a dichotomy there because he seems also extremely.
Well, he wasn't pushing anything, but he,
right.
but he, you see,
he doesn't want
he
to,
lived before the internet. Careful. That's the thing. He liked doing interviews as a way of having a conversation with his fans.
Got it.
So, I mean, you know, quote unquote conversation, but he, and towards the end of his life, he gave some fantastic interviews. And one of those interviews is the yeah. one that you're seeing over and over again. And there's a little fun story maybe before, uh-huh. like several pieces of archival in this film, mm-hmm. You know, it got to us by way of sort of Grateful Dead logic where, you know, there's one excerpt from this interview that's gotten repeated a lot, but it's in print. And he said, the reporter asks, how do you feel about the fact that people think you're God? This is 1993. And he says, I'll put up with it until they come for me with the cross and nails.
Yeah.
Which is a great line. And I had heard it repeated, mm-hmm. but I never knew where it came from.
And it was in that.
Yeah. What happened was we found the reporter. It was for a magazine that is now defunct. The reporter was in India. It's called Magical Blend, like a new age magazine.
Gotcha.
And and we got a hold of the reporter. He was traveling in India, and all this stuff is pretty fun and cliched. Of course, he's in India. Of course, but the surprise was he said, I happened to have videotaped that interview, even though it was for print. But I just figured I'm sitting here, might as well record. The
yeah.
tape. So was that something you'd be interested in? And we said, of course. You know, a lot of this stuff has been seen on YouTube already. Before. So
right.
he said, and then of course, and then like,
so he had never released this before.
No, he had
this
never.
This is the first time.
He'd
this...
been living in a storage facility, and he said, you know, could you help me out with the money to, you know, pay for the thing or something like
right.
that? And we did that, and then we got a hold of the tape, and it had been sitting there so long that it no longer worked. So we had to rescue the tape, you know, sent it to the tape doctors or whatever, and they cleaned it up and baked it or whatever they do. And suddenly there was this amazing interview with Jerry Garcia.
What format was it?
It was in, like, I think, high eight.
Okay.
Yeah, it must have been high eight.
Hmm.
Amazing. So yeah, so that's the story behind that.
Said?
That's 93.
And what day? When did he pass away?
95. Yeah.
Mm.
Yep.
So it's like one of the last.
Yeah,
the
it
last
really is.
Depth.
It's one of the last, and he's so on. And there's just like one amazing line. You know, that line is in there, and it made it to the film. But there are others that are just, you know, he's in a really reflective mood. One of the things he says, you know, this is at the height of their popularity. And it's sort of right before he takes a nosedive with his health and his heroin addiction. So on some level, it may not be the last interview, but it's close to, you know, there were a few in 95, but they're pretty, he's not well. Mm-hmm. So this one is amazing. And he says at some point, see, I had a lot of reservations about the Grateful Dead for, you know, for the first 20 years or so. And the reporter says, what are you talking about? He says, the power. Nobody should have that kind of power. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, you hear this and you can't help but think about Trump, you know, or whoever. Right. Like, yeah. Here's a guy who's showered with adulation. He's living the dream. He's an international celebrity, and he's got these reservations about it, even though what he's doing is giving a lot of people a lot of joy. But he wanted people to understand that the joy that was being created was collectively created, and that was hard for most people to actually figure out.
Well, he was able to draw the line between what's you know, being a performer and you know, and an idol, whereas unlike a lot of maybe followers, you know, they were fans is maybe a better distinction. A lot of his fans were followers, and they were kind of, I don't want to sound patronizing, but they obviously, they were in search of something they really needed for their soul. They were on this journey. Now, I'm not talking about just deadheads who followed them around, but there was a fringe of in there that we see really did believe he was a some sort of god, and were, you know, having a literal religious experience at some of those concerts.
Yeah.
So, I think there is power there
story.
Because if
yeah.
you told them to yeah. drink the Kool-Aid,
yeah, and that's not a power that's, that. That's, smart
who wants
guy
that?
Wants to use.
No, exactly,
yeah.
right. Yeah. Who wants to? Yeah. Who wants that?
And, you know, I mean, and he also was probably disappointed by that kind of adulation, because for a long time there was a genuine partnership between the band and the fans.
Right.
And, you know, people didn't give him a hard time about autographs, and, you know, understood that there was something special going on that was co-created. And maybe, you know, while of course there were follower types all along, there were probably a good, I would argue, there were probably more non-follower fans than in any other rock band. It was a special pact between the band and the fans. And that was created at the outset by the fact that the band didn't perform in the normal way that, you know, the Rolling Stones might. They never went on stage with a set list. In case your audience doesn't know this stuff, I mean, the basic facts are that the band came on stage every night. They very frequently had any stage patter. They didn't dress up in any special way. They had no smoke bombs or lights or anything like that. They got up there, and what you were watching was not a performance, but some guys playing music, you know, creating music before your eyes. And anytime Jerry used to say that, when he figures out how to do the guitar solo exactly right, he'll never do it that way again.
Right.
Because he's trying to keep it interesting for himself.
Yeah.
You know, I saw the other night, I saw Roger Waters perform, and it was great because I love Pink Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then they came on and they played Comfortably Numb. And, you know, the guitar solo was exactly how you would hear it on the record. And, you know, I know that Roger Waters has been touring for like nonstop for the last many years. And
yeah.
I was thinking, this guitar player has probably played this solo exactly the same way 400 times.
He can do it in sleep.
You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. and you know, you feel bad for the guy, but you also feel bad for yourself a little bit because it cheapens it a little bit. And it feels like...
Well, you know, you're not getting something unique on that concert as a goer. I mean, from a performer's perspective, there is something to... Like anybody doing a play where they have to recite the same lines.
Right.
I mean, I suppose one could say there is some experience in repetition, and, you know, I don't.
But that's a problem of categories a little bit. Because, you know, there's music and then there's theater. And those are two different things.
It's true.
Theater works when, you know, the playwright has figured out the lines, and then why improvise too much? You know, maybe here and there you might
also
want
to. Also, you have an audience which you're responding to much more in a theater, in a theatrical, whereas the concert, the instrumentalist is not going to stop when the applause gets larger, you know, and wait for them to die down, just pick it up again. Whereas in a play, you may wait for, you know, the applause to end to start something, whatever it is. Anyway, there are a lot of distinctions to be made between them. Now, I don't know if this is a safe question to ask because it could put you on the spot, but I myself, even though I was never a Deadhead, I was a modest fan of the Dead, but I never had the desire to see them alive because I think I didn't start, I did see the Pink Floyd and I was got very stoned and I went up to look for beer and I got lost in a stadium. So it took me, you know, probably a half hour to find my friends who didn't notice I was gone in the first place anyway, so it's okay. But I didn't see the Stones. But I can say I'm fortunate because I was given tickets one time, or a ticket, to see Jerry Garcia with the Jerry Garcia Band play at the, I'm going to say it was the, what's the theater right on the Upper Side?
The Beacon.
The Beacon Theater. I'm almost certain it was the Beacon. I remember going and having never seen Jerry Garcia live before, the first half of the show was an acoustic set. The second half, this is when he was doing this, and the second half was
the Will Turn, actually.
Would have been in the 90s. Yeah. This would have been probably not.
It was 90.
Around the time. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. It would have been 1990. Because I remember where I was working, and it might have actually been earlier than that. I think it actually had been. Now that I think about it, it could have been a little earlier. Okay. Regardless.
Anyhow, yeah.
Not to get too far adrift here. But and I remember, because I was an avid reader of Rolling Stone magazine back then growing up, that Bill Graham was walking up and down the aisle just being sort of like, what a, you know, celebrity sighting Bill Graham, you know, for those who are my age who might remember who Bill Graham was. Sure. Very instrumental in Jerry Garcia's career. But so I do have that experience. I don't know. Did you ever have an opportunity to see him or the Dead?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, at the end there, it was more fun to see the Jerry Garcia Band because you see them in these small, beautiful venues.
Yeah, right.
Venues,
it was a very small venue. Intimate,
and that was much more, you know, you could see that he was enjoying it a lot more, I think, you know. I mean, I'm sure there were exceptions, but I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were, I mean, if you're not a Deadhead, I mean, I guess I would have, as a socially, I mean, I might have really, really had a great experience going to a Dead show because of just the experience all around. But I'm glad I got to see him play live in that particular setting. It was nice. But I kind of feel like I should have seen him in the Dead as somebody who loves to see live music. But
You know, I don't like to. Yeah, I mean, I try not to engage in that kind of thing because, you know, culture is constantly evolving and changing, and to state the obvious in a way. But I mean, you know, it's a wave, right? And the wave of interesting things is somewhere else right now. You know, maybe it's hip hop. Maybe it's I feel pretty confident it's not hip hop, as somebody who loved hip hop in the 90s. But, you know, there's something cool going on right now. And to the degree that there isn't something cool, that, you know, what you want to do is encourage people to go out and make something cool rather than, you know, feel like they missed anything. And, you know, there's a lot of that in the Grateful Dead, in rock and roll in general. There's a lot of that kind of, status mongering or something that, you know, where people say, I mean, especially with Jerry Garcia, you know, I mean, because the band kept playing in various incarnations and then, you know, people,
Bruce Hornsby.
Yeah. After Jerry died.
Yeah. No, I understand.
But you know,
He was there with Jerry Garcia too. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
Okay.
The, last line in the film that actually happens in the credits is Steve Silberman's, and Steve Silberman is a Deadhead and a writer and a beautiful human being who, you know, sort of exudes compassion. He's a Buddhist and he's a wonderful thinker, and he says, I wish to. He says something to the effect of, "I meet kids today who are too young to have ever met Jerry Garcia, and they're just as big Deadheads as we were in the 70s. And the one sadness I would relieve them of is their sense that they missed something, because the magic that the Dead and the Deadheads created is going to keep working in whatever form it takes into the future. I think that's a beautiful sentiment. And I tried to have, you know, I put it at the end for a very deliberate reason, because I don't want, you know, there's something weirdly insular and almost tribal or aggressive or something about, you know, talking about a thing that happened already and boohoo, you missed it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure. So, and it also doesn't bring you anywhere.
Where does it go?
Regret,
yeah, exactly.
It's one of those things that really doesn't take you anywhere.
Yeah.
So you may as well let it go.
Yeah. Right.
Now, I mentioned before, I said that, you know, this was mostly the inner circle that we hear it, you know, the core, the surviving members are here, Phil and
Bobby and
Bob
Bill
Weir
and
Mickey Kreutzmann. Is it
Kreutzmann? Mickey Hart and Billy Kreutzmann.
Mickey Hart, of course. Yeah. And
Billy Kreutzmann.
Billy Kreutzmann. Mm-hmm. I know. Anyway, was there a temptation, or did you go through the machinations of considering, like, normally you'd cut to Dylan, cut to...
No, yeah, there was never
to Grace
that
Slick,
I can't stand that.
Tom Petty.
That was never a consideration.
Yeah. It wasn't.
I do not like that device, and, you know, apologies if anybody's listening to this who's a filmmaker who uses that device, but I try never to have anybody outside of my stories in my storytelling. So I don't
so
have...
So that's it, true with...
Yeah, if you look at Happy Valley... So now I have a cheat. I have a workaround.
Okay.
So let's say on my Kid Can Paint That...
Let's talk about Happy
I wanted
Valley.
To have Michael Kimmelman.
Who's this is my Kid Painted
yeah,
That?
Okay. Yeah. So okay. The reason that people do that is for context, right? You know, it's great to have people who are in the inner circle in your stories, but then sometimes you want to have the writer or whatever who... you know, or the critic, in case of music films, the music critic who can say, you know, when this album came out, it was seminal, blah, blah, blah. So I sometimes want that kind of context. And the way I do it is I find somebody who's actually part of the story, who has skin in the game. I introduce them as a character, not as and I get them
as
to say those
head
things.
Or an expert.
Right. So like I have in every one of my films, in Happy Valley, there's a professor whose opinions are similar to my own. His name is Matt Jordan, but he's a professor at Penn State. So he gets to talk in that way. When you first meet him, it's a sleight of hand almost that I do where, you know, you meet them as a character in a moment in time, and then you can let them do their expert thing. But I don't like in a music doc when people usher in another musician, and oftentimes it's somebody from a different era, like it's a contemporary musician. And it's almost always Will I Am or somebody, it'll be,
somebody who is influenced.
Yeah. It'll be like, Pharrell or whatever, say, oh, the first time I heard Casey Jones, blah, blah, blah. That to me is such a cheap shot. And it takes you out of the story,
Yeah,
and there's enough people inside the Grateful Dead's world who have that kind of a perspective. And the fun thing is, if you don't anoint somebody the expert, then you have a bunch of expert opinions and they don't jibe with one another. And that's what I have in almost every film, but especially on this one. You do get somebody said, here's how I see it. And then when you're in that soundbite, you go, gosh, he's the guy. He gets it. And then a couple minutes later, somebody says, nah, it's something else. And they're equally persuasive.
I see.
So yeah. I like to do that. And I don't like to have an authority in the film. That's why I rarely have a narrator or anything like that.
Right. But, I mean, like Dylan wouldn't have been a cheat because they toured together over time. But they also obviously played... I mean, second to their own material, Dylan was probably, they tapped his material.
Yeah. No, Dylan would have been fine.
Yeah.
But Dylan would have been a big hassle to get in touch with. And
It would have taken you out.
It would have taken you out of the story. Exactly. Because he's got too much star wattage.
Right.
He's his own film. There are a couple of, Bill Graham didn't make it into the film for different reasons, but also, sometimes you want somebody to come into the film if they have story, like a good story traction.
Just Bill part Graham. In the story, or are you talking about because Bill Graham died, right?
Yeah, but I mean, mentioning him, you know.
Yeah.
There's sort of, I didn't find that there was anything I needed to say about Bill Graham or anything that like you could hook in with a piece of story, you know.
And he came in late enough, didn't he? I mean, he came.
He was around.
Oh wait, no, yeah, that's true. During the whole Fillmore, right? He was involved in that, right? Of course. Exactly. Okay. Well, Marty Scorsese. Let's see where we can start.
That's very apropos because he's another guy. There's very little story to talk about. He didn't. He didn't really involve himself too much with the film. His role
lent
was,
you.
He lent me his cat, his name, and his that's cachet, a big deal. Which is a very big deal. And it's the only reason I'm sitting here talking to you because we had some hiccups. Which he helped smooth through.
He's like the fixer.
He's a fixer
in a way too, right? Or just his name can you throw? It's like
no, he did a little bit of fixing. Yeah,
I understand.
Yeah. And his name, so both. Right. So, but you know, he didn't. You know, I would have loved to have gotten into the edit room with him, and you know,
sure, Thelma.
But yeah, that would have been great, but it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But actually, his docs. Are cut by, for the most part by David Tedeschi, mm-hmm. who did come in and give us feedback.
Okay.
And he's a fan, you know. So the films that you're thinking of,
the music
that's
ones,
David Tedeschi.
Thelma's not on those. No. She's on the dramatic features,
right? David Tedeschi is an unbelievable.
Well, I got to get him on the show too, then.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's
because I like to bring on editors and.
Oh yeah, yeah, and you should talk to my editors too. I mean, they've got lots to say. Yeah,
and I'm sure I've talked to a lot
of... You know that music... I mean, excuse me, documentary editors mm-hmm. are like the co-director.
Right. Yeah, it's a collaboration, no doubt about it. Yeah. And so it wasn't necessarily a... But that must have been... How did that... Because people are, of course, it's like...
people want
to
know.
A lot of filmmakers are going to listen to this. So in a way, maybe it's not the greatest thing to share because...
I gotta
too
be
many
honest
people
about
are tapping,
it.
Into the Scorsese. I'm just curious how something like that comes about. I guess planets align, we can say.
It's just what all filmmakers do. You know, you network and triangulate. And,
sure.
With this film, I had to do a ton of that mm-hmm. because I could not get the freaking band to finally like move forward. It took 11 years really to get them to agree to do this, and then once we did move forward, there was like a moment with some cold feet happened. You know,
right?
They're incredibly, they're notoriously inertial. You know, and so if there's just one person around them who has some misgivings or whatever, a thing doesn't happen.
Oh,
in fact, I literally was working on it for 11 years, and at one point. John Barlow, one of the characters in the film and somebody from the inner circle there said, oh yeah, Jerry used to say, Grateful Dead Productions, the place where great ideas go to die. So, you know, that's what I was dealing with for some time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But was it always the intention to make I don't know, obviously you didn't think to yourself, I'm making a 4-hour film.
No.
Was it always the intention to do a long and deep?
No. I have to tell you, I have a signed contract, that says I'm to make it no longer than 90 minutes.
Okay.
So we actually were meant to do a short film that was in time for their 50th anniversary, and we blew right past that deadline and threw that duration and but we did that organically and improvisationally.
Yeah, and was Scorsese agreed already to do the EP work EP prior to the before the running time was established?
Yeah.
So in other words,
yeah.
So that has got to be a good thing to have in the pocket because even at 4 hours you're going to say, well, Scorsese's EP.
Yes.
So it's going to
Right. Yeah.
And also
that's exactly what I did a lot of the time.
Yeah. Well, that's what's there for.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you do that? Right.
Right.
I mean, you'd be foolish not to.
Yeah.
And all the
nobody trusts me.
And all the limo rides around town.
Yeah.
nobody trusts you.
Yeah.
Well, they'll trust you after seeing the movie because
hopefully it
delivers.
Thanks.
We can say that. I mean, people should, you know, if you're a fan or if you just love music, there's a number of ways into the story for folks loving documentaries. This is a great one to see in the theater, as we already said, because the sound alone is going to blow you away. And then it will be on Amazon.
Yes, Amazon Prime on June 2nd. And I think, I you know, I'm painfully aware that very few people are indifferent to the Grateful Dead. You know, as somebody who's been trying to make a film about them for, you know, 14 years, I've seen it. I know how to, like, you know, I know the glaze that goes over people's eyes when you talk about the Grateful Dead, but then adding
well,
to the fact
marijuana.
That it's for, yeah, no,
that's not,
no, the, but there's,
or,
there are two or, different glazes, right? There's the glaze of fans. That's usually marijuana. And then there's the glaze of non-fans who think, I just don't like that band.
Right.
And
it's true. There is
there's a divide, right? So, yeah. I always feel compelled to say, you know, when I get an opportunity like this to say, you know, this is, I'm not making this film for fans. It's really for like non-fans more than it's for fans. I'm happy with the response from fans, but I didn't make an insider film, you know, with rose tinted glasses. And I like to think, you know, that it's a film that's another, it's got a lot of the concerns of my other films. So if you like my other films, then, you know, I think you'll see that this is of a piece with them. And even if you've never seen any of my films, but you are, as you said, a rock and roll fan, this is hands down, I think this is a great rock and roll story. And 'cause it's not, it's an anarchic story, mm-hmm. you know, and it's well thought out anarchy, you know, I mean, there is the requisite hedonism and bad behavior, and we have a lot. And you know, these are like home movies that have been stewing for a long time because nobody's ever made a film. So we have great material that's fun and entertaining, but also these guys were committed to anarchy in a thought out way. Well thought out way. So you know, it's I like to think of this as a utopian story. You know, it's a kibbutz story as much as it's a rock band story. It's about a collective anarchist collective, you know, and like great utopian stories, it collides with reality at a certain point and makes you, I think, I hope it provokes you to think about your own choices and your own values and in the way that stories about heroic, you know, aspirations usually do. So, yeah, that's a long-winded way of saying, you know, just because you don't like the Grateful Dead doesn't mean you shouldn't see this movie.
Amir Barlev is the director of Long Strange Trip.
Yeah.
And it's opening up on Friday. It's this Friday, you said?
It's going to be in theaters on Thursday. May 25th.
Oh, that's...
And then if you're hearing this afterwards,
it ends on Friday though. That's the
it's
that long.
Then it's going to be one night only at 50 different screens, and then it'll be in New York and Los Angeles for a week.
Oh, okay. Let's back this up. Then I do. That's right. I do remember reading this on the press release. So this is going to be a one night only. Sort of a concert approach to
something like that,
simulcast
kind
of thing,
something like that
of a documentary though, and that's on Thursday,
right? But beginning Friday it'll be in New York and Los Angeles,
the 25th, and then the 26th of May it'll be playing in a limited theatrical, and then on June 2nd. On Prime. Yeah.
You got it.
Oh, got it. Okay, very good. Well, thanks a lot. It's finally great.
It's great talking.
I mean, if I had the, I'd want to go into your entire, you know, oeuvre, because I do enjoy those films, and I'm sure I have lots of questions about all those, but for another time.
Yeah, right. We could do a part two.
Yeah.
All okay, right. Great.
Really, thanks a lot.
Nice talking to you. Thanks.
We should have known something was coming when there were more people outside the show than there were inside.
There was a strong belief that it'd be leaderless.
Who was in charge?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that. There were times when I was in charge, times when Jerry was in charge. Your truck that had a blown carburetor. That carburetor was the boss.
It was total chaos.
Spinners would be out in the hall, and they'd be bowing because they thought Garcia was a problem.
Jerry Garcia did not bargain to be the mayor of a traveling countercultural town.
It was a machine by then. Do you know how many people are depending on this show going down the road? Where's the freedom in that?
It's not up to us to define the Grateful Dead. It's this living, breathing thing.
I think that's one of the parts of its magic. Not defining it is that it becomes everything.
Okay, well, I was just talking to Lorenzo, or emailing with Lorenzo today when I alerted, or yesterday when I alerted him that we were going to post this show that we recorded a few weeks ago. And he says he wanted me to mention that as of Friday, today, there will be the whole new Asian Voices campaign, or new Voices series will be available on Filmatique. And then starting next Thursday, they're going to be doing Brazilian cinema. So I'm very excited because I love both parts of the world when it comes to films. I love Brazilian films especially. Again, if you go to filmatique.com, and that is spelled FILMATIQUE.com, you can first explore it. By the way, they have not only can you explore the content before deciding whether or not you're going to subscribe, but they also have a blog you can look at. And you can, it's just a terrific site with the real film lovers behind it. So please do check it out. Consider subscribing. This is my conversation with one of the founders of Filmatique. His name is Lorenzo Fiuzzi. Lorenzo Fiuzzi, correct? Did I get that right? Grazie. And you are, as you were just saying, you're splitting your time between Brooklyn and Rome.
Yes, I'm trying to do my very best to keep doing that as much as I can.
How long have you been here?
I moved here 8 years ago.
Oh.
I moved to New York 8 years ago. But the splitting time thing is just like a recent thing. It's like in the past 2 years, I'm trying to do a little bit more
I see.
Back and forth. But before I was only staying in New York.
Gotcha. I had another friend in the neighborhood, actually, right in the immediate area, in one of these buildings. I can't remember which one. I wonder if I have his address. He's another Italian expat. That's the only reason I bring him up. Named Christian. But
what's his name?
Christian. Christian Cassan. But
it doesn't ring a bell.
He's a musician. Very talented. Anyway, so we're here to talk about Filmatique, which is a streaming on demand.
Yeah, it's a SVOD platform.
Yeah, SVOD, as they say.
Subscription VOD platform.
Subscription. And now, so when did you come up with this idea? And it's very, very targeted to an art house audience, for sure.
Well, I used to go with my current business partners. We used to go a lot to film festivals, but like mostly European. And we were watching films, not in the main session competitions, but more like in Uncertain Regard in Cannes, or like Critics Week, or Fortnight, and then going to Venice and watch Horizonte, and like all like all those festivals. And we would find those. We were going to festivals because we were shooting a film. It was a year ago. So we were like just around and see how the whole thing, like which festival would be the right fit for us and everything. And then we started just watching all these amazing films and coming back then to the States and telling our friends. And then maybe like a year after, or like
they may get here or may not.
They normally don't.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh yeah, I watched a great film. Let's see what happened. Let's watch it again. And you're like, I can't find it anywhere. So I initially couldn't find most of the films that we have anywhere else. So it was to find a way to bring these films here and have them available for like a wider audience. Those obviously are not mainstream films, so it's very hard to distribute them theatrically. It's very hard to find an audience for them, but it's something that digital allows you to do. So it's like it allows you to bring these films, and like you can devote time to it, and at least they get some audience or some sort of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing it was that I, as much as I loved other art house streaming platforms, I always felt that the problem for those films is that even if they get on those platforms, they get lost in it because there is a problem of overwhelming quantity, I think, on those platforms. And we wanted to do quality over quantity. So we thought that those movies would we're getting a little bit lost. These are like movies that people don't know about. So if you throw these movies into a huge library, it's people continue not to know about it.
Right, right. No,
unless
absolutely.
You dedicate time to that. So we wanted to give the filmmaker its space on the platform. So we do every week we release a film. So for that week, at least for that week, that film has total attention. And we do reach outs for that. We contact embassies and consulate of the country of origin here in the U.S. We do interviews with the filmmakers. We do we write essays sometimes. So we try to give as much context to the film so that the film can be experienced in the way it should be experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least it doesn't get lost into like a huge like library and nobody knows about it. It's just like it's just another movie there.
Yeah, because unless the average person doesn't have the wherewithal to spend the amount of time required to really figure out where to find the films, which ones, how do you know? And most people don't go through film festival websites looking at, unless they have a vested interest.
Most people don't know. Like, if you see a film from Rotterdam, I know that Rotterdam is a great festival to find emerging filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
But like maybe the average audience don't know, or like Carlo Vivari, or
right.
like, you know, it's like Locarno. It's like there are so many festivals that maybe people don't know about. So.
Sure. Right. Yeah. I mean, the average people, even if they love films, they don't know even that maybe they've heard Vienna or Berlin have great festivals, but or Toronto, but they don't. And, you know, like we were kind of saying, also, a lot of these films just never end up here because even if they're great quality, I mean, oftentimes there's just such a narrow bandwidth. I mean, there's only a handful of cities where they could play in the United States, an international title. And then any given week, there's going to be quite a bunch. So there's only room for so many. So what happens to the rest?
It's also like I wish I could put all these films theatrically. But the thing is, like, sadly, it makes no sense for a distribution company to take one of those titles and distribute it like theatrical in the U.S. because obviously, like it's too expensive. Like there is no return in that, and so VOD or digital allows you to do that.
Yeah,
of course, in a kind of a, like
right. And then, the big, of course, the challenge is, like you said already, is then how do you, with all the tens of thousands of titles that are on some one streaming site or another, how do you still decide where you know which films you're going to see and how to, even if you are the kind of film audience person who really does like art house films and, you know, obscure international titles,
and you're
open to taking risks and, you know, discovering things, if you're like that kind of person and they exist. But even then, it's like, where do I don't know where to begin, you know. It's almost like an arbitrary.
It is a lot about discovering, which is, I think, the most fun part of it.
Right. But for discovering, even, it's nice when there's somebody there or an entity of some sort, which is like able
to. It's like a tastemaker.
Yeah, a tastemaker. So Filmatique is a tastemaker in that regard.
Hopefully, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, you're about to, as you said, you're in a beta mode, but people can already subscribe.
Yeah.
And it's filmatique.com. Filmatique.
Oh God, I'm so bad at spelling.
It's all right.
See things.
Filmatique.
Filmatique is like film boutique.
So. Yeah, gotcha. And then
film boutique.
Right, and then people can go and subscribe and they can. Is there a trial period too?
Do you have it's a 1 month free trial.
Okay, that's very fair. And
after that is like $4.95 a month. So.
That's very affordable. Come on, guys. People spend that on their coffee on the way to work in the morning.
Yeah, no, it's literally like the price of a latte.
Yeah. And but it's one payment a month. I mean, even all said, that's $60 a year, which
is $49.95 a year.
Oh,
there's a discount if you sign up for a year.
Oh, okay. Very good. So
there's also a discount if you sign up with FilmWax code.
Okay. Very good. That's good to know. So yes, if you put in FilmWax in the code there, that's good. So how do you reach out to these distributors? How do you,
I mostly work with, sales agencies.
Oh, that makes sense too. Yeah.
Because these films, like most of them, are not distributed in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, my main like
there is no U.S. distributor.
Calling clients or not,
right.
But
yeah,
my main reach out is sales agencies, and these are like people I met at festivals throughout the year, and then slowly I kind of got better and better in researching who has the films and who owns the rights,
right.
And like it's something that you kind of learn. And so you see which...
And do they pitch you? No.
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they pitch me. Most of the time it was me harassing them. So that was like especially in the beginning, because now there are a lot of... around the world, there are a lot of VOD platforms, because I have not reinvented the wheel. People have noticed that. So I'm just like an ancillary. So there are a lot of them, and many of them, and many sales agents don't trust what they're doing, because like there is a problem of transparency, and also there is the fact, oh, there are so many, and none of them pays really much, because like putting a film on demand, it's more for like visibility than revenue.
Sure, right.
And so they're like a little skeptical about it, but... So when I first started Contentland, my idea started a year and a half ago, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And I was just like this kid going up to them. I was like, oh, I'm going to get your films on a platform. I was like, well, we'll see about that. Mm-hmm. And then I started making a newsletter with my business partners. And we started making this new newsletter and started blasting it while we were in Berlin, 2016, I think. Yeah. And that newsletter actually picked up really fast. And at that point, they started reaching out to me. It's like, hey, we like your content. We like your newsletter. What is it that you guys are planning to do? So I'm like, oh, this is what we're going to do. We want to do a VOD platform. Mm-hmm. So this is just like for you to get an idea of our taste and our curation. Mm-hmm. At that point, they started listening to us more. And at that mm-hmm. point, they understood that we were like serious about what we were doing. And we really cared about the film. And we had like a very good eye and aesthetic. And like, the design was good. It was not going to be like just a bunch of film thrown somewhere.
Right.
And so that's how they started kind of like be more empathic. And
did you go to like a company like VHX or something?
I use VHX.
You do? Oh, okay.
I actually use VHX.
Okay. Yeah, because they're the essentially giving you the tools to put it on online and then also to create some sort of paywall or something.
Yeah. No, they're a fantastic company. I actually, in the moment that they announced that they were going to do subscription service too, uh-huh. That's when I decided, okay, now I can launch at least a test, because Filmatica is kind of entirely bootstrapped, so it's not really like any venture capital behind it, or we are three filmmakers, me, Melinda, and Ursula, they're my business partners, uh-huh. and we just wanted to create a space, a safe space, and a good space for world cinema in the US. Mm-hmm. So we did not have the ability of building something on our own, and so we were looking for like what can we use. And when VHX announced that, it was like, okay, this is the perfect fit of what we need. And that was like kind of also what it made us like, oh, now I can do this for real. So that's when I accelerated the acquisition process.
I see. So in a sense, it's the streaming sites that I've encountered. This is closest to, in a sense, you are recreating a theatrical approach to a streaming experience, because there are other services that work on a certain types of schedules and that have themes, but they are not like a week-long focus. Like, so you're marketing and streaming a film or a filmmaker, let's say, in a week, and that's a theatrical type of idea at this point. I mean, it wasn't in the past, but now like a theatrical is a week, truly a weekend, but it's a week. So it's an interesting approach to
well, the overall idea streaming. Was also to give to all these titles, since we present one film every week, uh-huh. it was actually to, in like a couple of theaters, to do a special screening before the titles goes in the platform. Because we kind of still wanted to give the opportunity of the film to have like at least one night in the cinema, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't want to kill cinema. So we wanted to do both things.
Right.
And obviously it comes down to like one step at a time. We're going to get there, hopefully. But that was kind of like the approach was that one.
I don't think there's any evidence that streaming sites are truthfully harming theatrical. In fact, I would say that a lot of people who do watch films regularly on streaming via streaming are the team that will go to the theaters, and if it's an option. Now there are some people with a young family or, you know, kids and stuff. Those people are not going to the cinema anyway as frequently, if at all, because they've got the kids and it's a big deal to, you know, now either you take the whole family to the movies, which is expensive, or you leave them home with a babysitter. So I don't look at it as competition. I don't, no. You know, they're more likely to stream films. I think, both streaming and theatrical both kind of create a momentum, if you will, you know, in general. This is me, my thoughts. I don't have empirical evidence, but I do see more theaters going up, at least in this town. I know Rome is a big movie city.
But like now, like theaters in the U.S. are used to this, and distributors are used to this, so they play, they work around this. Like they actually take advantage. They create like new distribution models and formulas. They're hybrid, where you can integrate the two things. So the, it doesn't really harm the cinemas or nor the platform. I think it's more the idea of like the VOD arming cinemas. It's a little bit more European in a way that it's streaming is a, it's newer right now. So distributors and screening rooms have not adapted to different distribution models or like integrating SVOD as a hybrid and like or like as a companion instead of like an enemy. So I think they're like a little bit more skeptical still in Europe because they're like a little catching up on these new like distribution models.
When you, in Rome, what is the what is the general feeling about streaming with people that go to the movies? Do you have a sense? Like if the, if that is still, is it they're more dedicated to bricks and mortar? I mean, or has it taken off?
I wish I had an answer for this.
That's honest.
It really depends. Rome is a city like Milan where people go to movies.
Yeah.
The rest of Italy, it's like it's very hard to like fill up a room. And,
Well, that I understand. So, but I don't even know if they're streaming things in those little villages.
They are like
they're
streaming
villages
from main service. Like we have a lot of we have Sky, and which is like it's a TV channel.
It's like a smart TV.
Yeah, it's a smart TV which works really well. But now Netflix has arrived last year.
Oh, it did.
Netflix only 15 years to arrive to Italy because of like other like premium channels. It's it's a little. I don't know. They don't like the idea of putting their credit card online or like for signing up for something that like there is a different conception of using a credit card and in general like spending money on monthly things like recurring expenses is an American model. It's not really an Italian model. Italians are like they save money. They don't like to spend money.
That's great. Yeah.
And so it's we'll see. We'll see where it goes because I'm actually hopefully going to start doing something like this in Italy too. So I'm exploring the scenario
the
there.
The terrain is
so I'm trying to understand if there is room for like a filmatic similar product.
Right.
To be done in my country, which I would love, by the way.
Yeah. I guess pay-per-view is a lot trickier. It's harder to rely on and, you know, it's a lot more volatile.
Yes.
A pay-per-view, which is your other option, right?
Like that.
If they're not, if the audience is, if let's say using this potential scenario that you described of a suspicion or about monthly subscription, the option, other option is paper,
like transactional.
Transactional.
But then they don't like the fact that for every purchase you have to put out your credit card, so you have to go get your wallet, look at the number, fill it in.
No, it's true, right? You're trying to reduce steps.
You're trying to do the steps
and reduce the opportunities for people to change their mind.
It's already hard enough to get a person to do it once to take out their credit card and put it in.
Can't you also have it once in the system and then? Then every time they watch something, they get charged.
Sure,
I think that's what Amazon is.
Yeah, Amazon does that. I think most services they do that now. I think they.
Yeah, they're transactional.
You better store a card and.
And then only use when you I think that might work, but you can't rely. I mean, let's say if you're getting if you have 100 subscribers, and you lose 2, or let's say, you lose 4 every month. You know, because you can see the evidence of it. You know what I mean? Then you know how to increase, and you know what to expect. But if it's if it's a transactional thing, it's a lot harder to potentially, to.
Well, I also
predict.
Think that, like, on a transactional way, at least this is for Filmatique. So we do monthly series now, right? So we're organized. Now we're doing post-Soviet cinema. And then we done Band Nations.
What's post-Soviet? Oh, it's contemporary Russian.
No, it's...
or is it contemporary, like... so it's Kazakhstan and...
Exactly.
It's Kurdistan and it's...
Azerbaijan, Georgia.
Okay. Oh, very good.
That's like we're talking about like
Ukraine?
More northern Caucasus. Yeah, but we're a little bit more like on the northern... Caucasus area.
Okay, Mongolia?
No, it's Kyrgyzstan.
Okay. Very good.
We have one from Tajikistan?
Oh, right, of course. We're very well known for films. Yeah, but I go to their film festival every year.
going back to the subscription instead of transactional, by doing monthly series like that.
Yeah.
It's for us, it makes more sense to have like a subscription base rather than a transaction base,
right?
Because it becomes more about what Filmatique as a tastemaker has to offer every month, mm-hmm. that you can watch freely, rather than I am presenting to you each movie and you would have to purchase every single, mm-hmm. like every single film separately.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. It's a package. It's packaging.
It's also
stuff.
Like it's harder to sell.
You're packaging concepts more than our individual
those
films.
Those titles by itself, they don't have enough like of a name.
Context.
Exactly. They don't have context. Yeah. They're not big enough to be.
No, totally. Similar. It absolutely makes sense to package themes. You know, I can appreciate that too. So now you mentioned you were a filmmaker too. So have you made a feature or have you?
So yes, we have. As part of Filmatique Originals, uh-huh. So it was a Filmatique production.
Okay.
And it's a movie that we shot in Tuscany, uh-huh. and we actually just finished it in March, in March 2017.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And, hopefully now we're going to get into festivals. So we have a few festivals that we're waiting and hoping to get in, mm-hmm. right now in the next couple of months. And I produced a film. So I'm part of the production team. It's still the three of us. It's the same partners, uh-huh. Ursula, which is the curator of the platform. She's the editor of like the old like written stuff, like the magazine, mm-hmm. and like the, mm-hmm. She's the head curator. She is the director of the film, and Melinda and I, which most likely we kind of like do more like run operations.
And
I do acquisitions.
And did Ursula write it as well, or
Ursula wrote it? Yes.
Okay. And what's the name of it?
So it's we called, can look out for it. Noble Earth.
Noble Earth?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a comedy. I don't know why I said that. It could very well be, but it sounds like a hefty title.
No, it's not. It's like it's a very good first time.
Mm-hmm. Did you use like emerging actors?
Yeah, we used emerging actors. We also used a lot of like real people in real places. Mm-hmm. It's a very authentic portrait of Italy's new lost generation in a certain way.
Oh, okay.
So,
filmmakers that have come out of Italy, for instance, that you have a particular fondness for? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No.
He's already sweating. He's perspiring. You don't have to answer that. I always feel cornered when anybody asks me anything to do with favorites because puts me on the spot because I have to think about like what's the last movie
I'm actually thinking of like what is the last good Italian film I saw on like on the art house kind of like scenario, you know. It's like I'm not going to talk to you about like The Great Beauty because thank you.
Well, Sorrentino's I do
I mean,
like
then you
although
might like
he's
it or not.
I like his Italian films, you know, a little bit more than his American films, but
yeah, I didn't love his American films
or his French one. I didn't see Youth. I don't think I saw that.
I haven't seen Youth either.
Yeah,
but yeah. No, nobody really comes up to my mind right now at the moment.
Yeah. Well, okay, so people can go again to Filmatique, their website, and start rummaging around and consider subscribing because you know, if you're a film lover and you love international cinema. This seems like a really excellent spot.
It's like traveling around the world with films.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't need a passport. You just need, I guess you need a credit card. But that's a very good, price point is low.
It's very low.
I mean, that's very.
I think it's actually one of the lowest you consider around.
It's the lowest I've seen, so it's a real bargain, you know. And then once you have the, you can always jack it up, like, you know. Once you've got your listeners and they don't read the fine print, you know, then all of a sudden they look at their credit card statement, $25. Wait, I'm kidding. I won't.
That's not that low anymore. No, we thought it was it's a good price point. It's like it's cheap enough for anyone to be able to give it a shot and enjoy
right.
it. And we need to pay the films anyways and the filmmakers, so we need to charge something, and that's kind of
of course.
Balance in a certain way.
And sure,
we do have expenses, and I mean, we don't really pay ourselves yet, obviously, because we launched mm-hmm. like 4 months ago, so mm-hmm. it's like obviously mm-hmm. still like figuring it out. And
sure,
like, but yeah, I hope it's a good price point.
No. Like I say, it's a very good bargain for considering. You know, this is great new films and new filmmakers and.
But the cool thing is that then there is the whole like magazine part. So every film is accompanied by like written content, and that's mm-hmm. free. That's for everyone to read, and mm-hmm. it's, so that you can like gather information, read, get excited about a film or something, like know more, and then eventually, if you want, you watch the film. There is not like paywall at the beginning. Like there is, we'll let you browse around and
explore. That's
so good. Everyone in the world can read that. So that the films are like actually like kind of promoted around the world for what we can,
even in China.
Yes.
Wait, what's your next month? What's the next theme?
Asian New Voices.
Asian New Voices.
Yes.
So, South Korea and beyond.
And beyond. No, yeah, we have China, we have
Vietnam,
Japan. We have something from, we actually have a pretty good balance of like East Asia and Southeast Asia. So we're gonna have, I think, Vietnam and Indonesia and South Korea and China.
Okay. And Hong, I guess Hong Kong is
big. Four films.
Yeah. Okay, very good. All right. Well, thank you very much. I mean, come back on, you know, when
waiting for your next invitation.
I will make sure to get you one. It's let's meet back again and see how things go. And after a good year of the service being out there in the world, and I wish you a lot of luck with it. It's fantastic.
Our birthday's in November. So
what's that?
Oh, our birthday is going to be in November.
All right. Well, if you have a little party, let me know. Good luck with Noble Earth too, with the festivals. Maybe that'll be another reason to bring you on too.
Thank you.
You know, you can talk about that. Okay.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Sure. Thank you. To FilmWax Radio on iTunes, go to iTunes to the store and search under FilmWax Radio, or just on your podcast app. If you're not listening to the show on Rooftop Films website, and I realize I haven't really talked about Rooftop Films very much, so I'll get back onto that next week on the next show to help. But they had a great opening weekend last weekend, and I did make it to the shorts night. I didn't make it to Saturday night screening and concert, unfortunately. Life intrudes, parenting intrudes. Damn, being a parent when you want to just see films, right? Those children have a way of just getting in the way, you know? But it does happen, and I apologize for missing that, but I'm going to try to be at as much of the Rooftop Films events as I can. In the meantime, if you could subscribe to my iTunes account, which is FilmWax Radio on iTunes, and then subscribe, leave a comment, and of course a rating, as I always ask you to do. You can find us on FilmWax, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, on Instagram. Just follow us and like us and do all those things. Twitter. Did I mention Twitter? Okay, everybody, listen. FilmWax Radio is presented by Rooftop Films, and we're part of the Showbriz Studios podcast network. Till next time, do take care of yourself and the ones you love. Broken lines, broken strings. Broken threads, broken springs.